Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24. We'll be going through the entire chapter this morning as we continue looking at 1 Samuel. And so I know we've been off for a couple weeks. Pastor Logan did a fabulous job last week talking about the Trinity. If you missed that sermon, let me encourage you to go back and watch the Facebook video. You will not be disappointed. It will be a lot, I will be honest with you. But it is one of the most thorough and complete Trinity talks that you can probably do in one sitting. And so Pastor Logan did a great job. Before that, we were looking at some Christmas ideas. And so it's been almost a month since we've been in 1 Samuel. So let's kind of recap where we were. In chapter 23, Saul was pursuing David. David had gone to help. David had been in the wilderness before that, and David had gone to help a city called Keilah from the Philistines, and him and his men saved Keilah. And then Saul found out, and David got word that Saul was coming to Keilah. And so David prayed. Prayed and asked the Lord, "What should I do?" The Lord revealed the people of Keilah would give him up to the Philistines. And so David and his men fled, and Saul followed them, and Saul almost catches David. There, you can kind of, you know, this may be not the correct way it happened, but, you know, sometimes you kind of use your imagination and you can kind of I'm a visual learner, and so I like to visualize things. And so I kind of imagined it like one of them old Westerns, you know, where the smoke's coming up or the dust is up from one group and the other group's just behind them and they can see the dust and they're getting closer. And that's how I envisioned the end of chapter 23. But it ends with Saul being called away. He's almost captured David and his men, but he's been called away to go fight a greater enemy, the Philistines, and that's kind of how the story ends. And in fact, the chapter ends, and the text tells us that David goes to the strongholds of En-Gedi. And that's where chapter 24 picks up. So let's read verse 1. We'll read some of chapter 24 this morning. We won't read every verse. Let me encourage you to go back and kind of catch up on that at home. But I want to read verse 1, and then I'll talk about En-Gedi just for a minute, okay? So when Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." So Saul went home to fight the Philistines, or went to another part of Israel to go fight the Philistines. When he was finished with that, he received word, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Now, let's talk about En-Gedi just for a minute. And it's going to be important because there's at some point you're going to ask, how did Saul not know David was there? You're going to ask that question in just a minute, okay? So En-Gedi is truly an oasis in the middle of the desert. En-Gedi is on the very western cliffs on the edge of the Dead Sea. And there's an image, if you can Google it, and you can Google Oasis of En-Gedi, and there's this one image. I should have brought it up this morning, should have put it on the computer. And it's from the Dead Sea. You're east of En-Gedi, and you're looking west. And behind En-Gedi, it is like mountainous desert. Like, literally, it is nothing but different shades of brown. It looks like it is devoid of life. And right around En-Gedi, it is vibrant green. The reason for that is because En-Gedi houses the largest springs on the west side of the Dead Sea. And so it was a known place, even in David's time, for shepherds to feed and water their sheep, for travelers to stop for water. And actually, there was so much water that they had well-known olive groves and vineyards to grow grapes there. There was that much water in the midst of this desert, of a sea of desert behind it. So David and his men are in En-Gedi for the water. They're there for the water, right? Also around En-Gedi, because it is mountainous and water, what has happened is all caves have formed. And so the land around En-Gedi is dotted with caves, likely from water erosion and from the nature of the mountains and all of that. And so there also are waterfalls. And so in this one part, you can go to En-Gedi today, and you can take a bathing suit, and you can walk from the desert, and you can go down there, and there the pool, like there's waterfalls. Now, it's not like Niagara Falls, okay, so don't get that. But there's waterfalls, and there's pools deep enough that, you know, people a little bit taller than me could go in there and swim, and it could be up to your, you know, around this level, you know. For some of us, it might be up to here. But you get the picture. Like, it's big enough to swim in, and you can do that today. So that's why David and his men are in En-Gedi. All right, now let's read the next couple verses. Let's read verse 2 and 3. All right, here we go. Then Saul took 3,000, now look at the next word, chosen men. In other words, Saul looked around the army and said, I want the best of the best men. I need 3,000. So he doesn't just choose anybody. He chooses the best of the best, right? Chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. Obviously, that was a part of En-Gedi or near En-Gedi. Now listen to it. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way where there was a cave. Now this, again, is not out of the ordinary. There are sheepfolds because there are shepherds there because they graze their sheep on the cliffs and then water them at the springs of En-Gedi. And Saul went in, and this is exactly what you think it means. Saul went in to relieve himself. That means he went in to do number two. Okay? Now, if you go watch the movie David that is playing in the movie theaters right now, they will tell you, because my sister told me this, they show this scene, Saul goes in to cool down because he's hot. He did not go in to cool down because he was hot. He went in to use the bathroom. It is what you think it means, okay? All right, now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. Here's the point where you think, how did Saul not know they were there? One, waterfalls make noise. Two, the cave is rather large. And so there's an inner part and an outer part. Saul doesn't go into the inner part. He doesn't need to. He just got to go to the bathroom. David and his men are in the inner part, right? Plus, have you ever walked in and you've been in the bright light and you walk into a dark room? You don't see really well. The people inside the dark room see a lot better when they're looking toward the light. You've all been in that situation, right? Okay, so that's the setup. David and his men are in the caves in En-Gedi because there's water and safety there. It's hard to get to. Saul knows he's there, but he doesn't know where. He takes 3,000 choice men. Saul goes in to relieve himself and ends up in the exact cave where David and his men are. Now, the center point, the focal point of this story is in the next four verses, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So let's read all of them, and then we'll come back. All right, so let's read 4, 5, 6, and 7. And the men of David said to him, here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. Then David arose and stealthily cut off the corner of Saul's robe. Verse 5. And afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Verse 6. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. Verse 7. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. All right, this is the focal point of the story, okay? So let's go back to verse number 4. All right, so David and his men are in the cave. Saul walks in to relieve himself. Now, obviously, David had men that were posted as sentries toward the opening of the cave because they see what's happening. They see Saul coming up, and they're like, surely he's not going to come in this cave. Surely he's going to go somewhere else. Oh my gosh, he's coming up here. I mean, you can kind of see the action going on. They run to the innermost part of the cave, and what do? They say, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your hand." They might not have said it this loud. It was probably in a whisper, right? "Here's the day the Lord's promised that He would give your enemy into your hand. You shall do to him as seems good to you." Now, here's the interesting part. They are seemingly quoting a prophecy, right? That's like prophetic language. The interesting thing is, you will not find that prophecy anywhere in the Bible. Nowhere. It is not in any part of the Old Testament. It's not in 1 Samuel. It's not quoted later. Nowhere. So you have a choice to make, and we don't really know which one it is, but here's the reality. Either A, they're quoting a legitimate prophecy that God did give David. We just don't have it recorded. And they're misapplying it to Saul. Or they're quoting some false prophecy that God really didn't say to David. Now, it doesn't really matter for our story. What does matter is the men around David are like, "David, this is the golden opportunity we have been waiting for. Here is Saul who has tried to kill all of us. And he's alone in a cave and nobody knows we're in here. This is the day. This is, to quote the scriptures, this is the day the Lord has made and we shall rejoice and be glad in it." Why? Because God has given us this opportunity. That's the sentiment of the men. What do the men want David to do? Kill him. Clear. So what does David do? David arises, stealthily creeps toward Saul while Saul is relieving himself and cuts the corner off of his robe. Right? Could David have killed him? Yes. Does he? No. He only cuts the corner of his robe off. Now, look at verse 5, because this seems interesting. Verse 5 says, "And afterwards," so after David has stealthily crept up there and stealthily crept back to his men, to the innermost part of the cave, it says David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, why? This was interesting. I had to do some research on this because it doesn't make sense. Like, he should be like, euphoria, like, "I could have killed him, but I didn't. I did the right thing. I just cut the corner of his robe off to show that I could have killed him." Right? So why does David's heart, like, the word there, heart struck him, means like he feels angst or he feels like conscience stricken as to why he's done this. Well, here's a little backstory or a little cultural significance of probably why David was like, ugh, after he cuts the corner off. Right, so here's the first thing. The first thing is, God gives very specific instructions in the Old Testament for a lot of things. One of those things is for how garments are supposed to be made and worn. And remember, Saul is the king, and so he's supposed to be the primary example of following the law, following the Torah. If anybody should follow God's law, it must be the king, right? He's the king. He's the point person. Well, part of that is how these garments are made, and there's really specific detail on the corner of how these garments are supposed to be made and worn, and it's specifically worn in worship settings. And now, what is Saul's garment? Not fitting for a king. But let me ask you this. If the president were going somewhere, he goes to a lot of sporting events, right? President Trump likes to go to sporting events. What if somebody, while he's at a sporting event, pulls out their pocket knife and whoosh, lops off the corner of his suit? You think he's going to wear that suit anymore? Not a chance. Same thing going on here. The added difference here is, it is a law that God said it needs to be this way. Right? And so David has just made Saul's garment unusable for him forever. Or until it's repaired, but probably forever. Now, here's the second thing. Here's the culture implication. And this is specific for the culture that David is living in. Whenever a corner of a king's garment is cut off, it is a symbol of a transfer of power from one person to the person who cut the corner off. So what is David just in some way said? Power is transferring away from Saul and toward me. Now, his men totally would get that when David went, well, one, they're probably sitting in the back of the cave. And we see this because in verses 6 and 7, verse 7 says, David persuades them with these words and would not allow them to put out their hand against the Lord's anointed. In other words, when David comes back without Saul's head and with the corner of the cloth, yes, they totally get what the corner of the cloth means, but what do they want to do? Hey, David, I get you don't want to do this. I'll be glad to do it. Let me be the guy. You can have plausible deniability. I'll be the man. I'll do it. I'll be the guy who kills Saul. You don't have to worry about it. But what does David say? No. Not only will he not do it, he doesn't let his men do it either. And so he persuades them, this is the Lord's anointed. We are not going to put out our hand against him. We are not going to kill him. We're going to let him leave. You can imagine the faces and the conversation and the thoughts that were going on in the innermost part of the cave. Like, what are we doing? Right? Now, but that's not the end of the story. That's only the first seven verses. What happens after that? Well, in verses 8 through 15, we're not going to read all those, Saul leaves, right? The end of verse 7, Saul leaves. So the men of David are already like, what are we doing? Like, you didn't have to, I'll do it. Like, you don't have, I'll do it. And David's like, no. And so Saul leaves. Then, if that's not enough to like drive David's men like, what is he doing? David starts walking toward the entrance of the cave. And you can imagine somebody's like, hey, whoa, whoa, hey, hey, whoa, hey, what are you, whoa, come on. What are you doing? And David gets closer to the front, closer to the front. And then as Saul has made his way out of the cave and kind of down, David hops out of the cave for everybody to see. And if that's not enough, hollers out to Saul. Now remember, there's only a hand. I mean, I don't know if all 600 of David's men are in the cave. Like, that would be an enormous cave if all 600 of them are in. But clearly they don't have 3,000 men that Saul have, right? So they are severely outnumbered. At best, it's what, 5-1? I mean, I don't know how many people are in the cave, but I mean, it could be 20-1, 30-1, 50-1, right? Who knows? So David and his men are in the cave, and David pops out and hollers out at Saul. Hey! And then David presents Saul with five kind of thoughts, and I want to give you those five thoughts this morning. Here they are. This is summarizing verses 8 through 15. Here's the five thoughts that David gives Saul. He says, number one, Saul, you've been listening to a bunch of liars. In other words, David is saying, you got a bunch of yes men and hype men in your camp, in your ear, that are leading you to ruin. They are telling you lies about me. You need to stop listening to them. Number two, he says, the Lord gave you into my hand and I spared you. In other words, Saul, what are the chances that you would walk in the one cave that me and my people are in? In other words, you could have picked any cave out here, but you picked the one that we are all in. The Lord put you in this cave and we spared you. Number three, I have not sinned against you. Remember Saul's whole thing way back when he was talking with Jonathan is about David sinning against Saul. And David is like, no, I have not sinned against Saul. I have not done anything wrong. And Saul continues to believe that David has sinned against him in some way, shape, or form. And David again is like, hey, bud, I don't care what those liars say. I haven't done anything against you. And David hasn't. Then David asks a question. Why do you keep hunting me? Why? Well, what are you doing? And then lastly, and here's kind of the coup de grace of this, David twice calls Saul to realize that God will be the ultimate judge between the two of them. Twice, David's highlighting this point. Hey, listen, bud, God is going to judge between you and me which one of us is right and which one of us is wrong. Right? So now Saul has an opportunity. What is he going to do? He clearly has the advantage. Might I remind you that as David is saying all of these things in verses 8 through 15, he is holding up the corner of Saul's garment, which I imagine at some point Saul quickly looked at the corner of his garment and realized it was really his and that his corner was gone. And then everybody else around Saul realized David could have killed him and he didn't, right? So Saul responds, and this time Saul gets it right. For all of Saul's ills, Saul gets it right here in this verse, or in this section. So verses 16 through 21, Saul realizes that it's David who is speaking, and he realizes that David could have killed him, but only cut the corner of his garment off. And Saul says basically two things. He claims or acknowledges that David is more righteous than him, and that, number two, David will be king one day. And then, strikingly, Saul offers David a blessing on his future reign. And then Saul, even though he doesn't have the leverage to make a request, he makes a request of David and asks David that after he's dead, that he would not kill his kids or his grandkids, which would have been the natural course of events. David agrees at the end of verses 21, and then in verse 22, it says they both leave. Saul realizes he has been bested, and Saul goes back home, and David and his men stay in the fortress of En-Gedi. All right, so that's the story. Saul's trying to find David. Saul walks into the one cave that David and his men are in to use the bathroom. David could have killed him. He didn't. Cut the corner of his robe off. David's men wanted to kill Saul. He wouldn't let them. Then he walks out, reveals with the corner of his robe in his hand that he could have killed you, but I didn't. You need to stop listening to liars. Why are you hunting me? I hadn't done anything wrong against you. You need to remember, Saul, God's going to judge between you and me who's right and who's wrong. And then Saul, in this case, does the right thing and says, David, you're more righteous. You're going to be king. May the Lord bless you when you become king. And please don't kill my kids and my grandkids. And that's the story. That's the end of the story. So the question is that we've got to ask ourselves, as we do every single week, we ask ourselves two questions. What's the main idea? And how does this apply to us? So let's talk about main idea. Well, the main idea is pretty easy. Don't kill the king. Right? Don't kill the king. And that is the main idea. Right? But it's not culturally relevant for us to just say don't kill the king. Because, I mean, you know, we don't have a king. But it's not really, that's still not really relevant. So if we go a little bit further, we need to see that there's a whole lot more in this passage. And I think we could clarify that point in making a main idea a little bit better. And I think we could say it this way. David didn't follow cultural norms. Instead, he spared Saul's life. Culture would have said, you're already going to be the next king. God has already said Saul was going to die. Remember? Saul's on his way out. Saul knows he's on his way out. Saul knows his kids are not going to be. There's going to be somebody else. David knows this. Everybody around David knows this. Culture would have said, hey, why don't we just help God out a little bit? Right? And so that's kind of the main idea. But here's some other things that we can learn from this passage. I got four things we can learn from this passage. Number one, David is truly a righteous man, right? Could have killed Saul. Could have beat Saul up. Could have let his men do all his dirty work, but he doesn't. He doesn't do it. He don't let any of them do it. Here's the second thing we can learn. David sets the precedent that regicide or king killing, king murder, will not be the way that kings transfer power in Israel. Now, that happens later. If you keep on reading in the Old Testament and you read 2 Samuel, and then you get into the books of 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, you will see that absolutely happens. And it happens as Israel falls further and further and further away from the Lord. But David says, we're not going to be about killing kings. That's not how we're going to transfer power from one king to the next. And that's a huge precedent. Because during that time period, that's exactly what happens. Exactly what happens, right? Here's the other thing that we can learn from David. And I think this would be probably maybe a little bit more kind of applicable for us. David doesn't fall prey to his own hype men. Think about it. We all have, I want to be clear. We all have people in our life that are encouragers, that are good people around us, who encourage us. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about hype men. You know, the people who pump you up. They're like the coaches at the football games or at the basketball games who are giving the impassioned speech and everybody's like, "Whoa!" Right? You know, we all have those people in our life too. And sometimes those people are really helpful. Like when we've got, as one pastor said, called it the mully grubs. You know, when we're just kind of down in the dumps. And those people sometimes help us, remind us of all the good that God has done in our life and all the things that God's doing, and they lift our spirits up. But sometimes hype men can be a dangerous thing. They're like, you know, your friends when you were in college. You know what I'm talking about. Hey, I bet you won't do that. Hey, come on. I bet you won't. I'll do it if you do it. We'll all do it if you start doing it. You know, like the time we were on the mission trip, and that sounded really bad. It's not going to end bad, I promise. It's kind of like the time we were on the mission trip in Brazil, and we're all in our 20s, and my friends and I, all of us guys, are sitting at the table, and the Brazilian guy who speaks Portuguese, not a lick of English, they just come around with meat. We're like a Brazilian churrisco type place, legit Brazilian one. You don't have any idea what you're eating. I know I ate a chicken leg. That's about it. And beef. What part of beef? No idea. And then the guy brings around these little bitty little things that are about that big. They look like hearts. And they were. They were chicken hearts. And the first time he came around, we were like, no, I ain't that hungry, you know. And then one guy at the table says, hey, I bet y'all won't eat one. Who are you? I'll eat one if y'all, and then it starts, you know, there's seven of us. There's six or seven of us. So we're all like, hey, I'll eat one if you eat one. And so them chicken hearts come back around, and we're like, hey, bud, hey, right here. See. El Plato, Plato, right here. And he drops six or seven, and all of us are like, all right, guys, we're doing this. And so it's on the count of three, one, two, three. And it was like eating a rubber band. It was disgusting. It was terrible. It was awful, right? Look, you got to be real hungry to eat a chicken heart. I'm just going to be honest. But you know what? We were all our friends, hype men in that moment. You know, we've all got those college stories. I've got a couple myself. You know, you normally, anyway, funny, good times. But sometimes those hype men get us in trouble, don't they? And we make decisions we wouldn't make because we've listened to the hype people in our life. David's soldiers were his hype men in this story. And had he listened to them, he would have believed some rando prophecy that was either misapplied or illegitimate to begin with, and he would have killed the king, or at worst, he would have been complicit in them killing the king. Right? And so sometimes we need to take stock of the hype men in our life or hype women in our life, because sometimes their advice isn't the best. Right? All right, so here's the other thing I think we can learn from this story. And this is more, I think, an implication of the story. We don't see this specifically said in the story, but I think the story absolutely implies this. David was speaking loudly to all the soldiers watching him. Think about the message that David was giving his own soldiers in the cave. David, what message is he giving? Well, one, he's saying, I am a man of integrity, and I expect you to be men of integrity as well. Saul was wrongly trying to kill David, right? He's clearly saying, hey, we don't deserve all of this. And now think about this. That's what he's kind of saying to his own people. But think about when David pops out of the cave, and Saul and the 3,000 men that are with Saul see David with the corner of Saul's robe, hear what David is saying. Again, this is not in the scriptures, but this is, I think, an implication. You have to believe or have to understand that there's some of the 3,000 soldiers, there's at least one that's saying, why are we following Saul? Why are we even out here? Why did I get out of bed and leave the comfort of my home to come follow David, following this guy? I think I ought to go with him, right? And that's one of the, like, kind of side effects, I think, that makes the transition for when David will eventually become king become a smooth transition. Because it's moments like this when David is a man of integrity, when he could have killed Saul, but he chose not to, and his actions speak louder than his words, because normally everybody knows what would happen, but it doesn't happen. Right? So somebody out there in Saul's army is thinking, ooh, I might be following the wrong guy. Because think about this. Think about the other side of what could have happened. I thought about this past week or 2 weeks ago when I was writing this message. What if David kills Saul? You ever thought about what might happen? I know it's what ifs and, you know, but think about it. What if David, instead of coming out of the cave with Saul's corner of his garment and Saul walking out, coming, what if he comes out of the cave with Saul's head? That's a legitimate option. But what if he comes out of the cave with Saul's head? Well, one option is those 3,000 soldiers that are not in the cave, they come in the cave. Right? So you got to think, what are the soldiers going to think? He just killed the king. It's war. Now we have a legitimate reason to go after this guy and his people. More than that, what's the nation going to think? What is the nation going to think when David, it is told that David killed the king so he could become king? Samuel is still alive at this point. He doesn't die till the next chapter. What is Samuel the prophet going to think? But here's the kicker. What's God going to think? Well, I think that's kind of the easiest one, right? We already know the answer. God's not going to be happy with David, because he killed the king. He killed the man that he anointed to be on the throne, even though God is moving away from Saul. So David allows Saul to live. He is a man of integrity. And so we got to ask, what can we learn from this? And I may have two on your outline, but I only want to highlight one this morning, because we're going to talk about the second one next week as well. And I think what we can see from this story that is a direct application. Yeah, we could say, hey, don't kill the king. Okay, got it. Be a man or a woman of integrity. Got it. But what did David do? What was his action point that proved him to be a man of integrity? It's really simple. He trusted the Lord's timing. And let's be honest, that's really hard sometimes. Sometimes we just want to help the Lord out just a little bit. Right? Hey, Lord, I know we're moving that. Well, let me just give you a little nudge, Lord. Let me just nudge you along, because you're not moving as fast as I want you to move, right? Everybody in the cave would have been totally fine if David would have just nudged the Lord a little bit. Like, Lord, I know I'm already going to be king, but what's a year or two earlier? 3 or 4 years earlier? I'm going to be that guy anyway. Let me just go ahead and help the Lord out a little bit, right? But David didn't do that. He said, I'm going to trust the Lord's timing. And I'm going to wait, and I'm going to be patient, and I'm going to trust that the Lord knows when I need to be king more than I know when I need to be king. And so that is the application for us. Don't rush. Now, don't be lazy and a laggard either. But let's trust in the Lord's timing, in the Lord's way. And in the end, we will prove ourselves to be men and women of integrity. And everybody around us will see that we were righteous and that we were following the Lord. Let me quote, I'm going to close by quoting David's son Solomon. I thought this was an appropriate way to close this message out. So in David's life, we can learn to trust in the Lord's timing. And Solomon, David's son, would write years later, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. You may know it. If you don't, here it is. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will make your paths straight, or straighten your paths, right? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will make straight your paths. And that is our challenge for this week.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.